we try to do all that we can to remediate, to prevent students from needing special education. We try to prevent educational casualties, as sometimes we call them, by doing all of these different interventions so that we don't have to refer as many students to special education. Yes, a lot of students do need special education, but a lot of students can be remediated.
Hi there, and welcome back to Preoccupied. Today we're talking to Mrs. Krista Seifert, a school psychologist.
Yep, that name may sound familiar if you listened to one of our earlier episodes with Dr. Seifert himself, who is Mrs. Seifert's husband. School psychologists play an important role in delivering research findings to the populations that they're intended to benefit. So with school psychology, what this often looks like is taking interventions that are developed in an academic setting based on theory and developed through trials and all that fun stuff, and then delivering those to schools.
School psychologists tend to work on the more, on a larger scale than, for example, therapists or even guidance counselors. There tends to be one school psychologist for an entire district rather than for just one school. A school psychologist might be responsible for implementing programs that are district-wide and dealing with special cases within their district of individual students.
Yeah. So a lot of their work goes on at the organizational level.
Yeah.
Sort of similar to Dr. Wong, who we're going to be talking with soon about IO psychology.
If you like these macro systems, stay tuned.
So at the individual level, one of the interventions that's been developed and then delivered by school psychologists to individual students, maybe those who are having issues with learning, is repeated reading. And what happens there is the school psychologist will identify a passage for the student to read and then ask that student to read the passage aloud. And they just repeat that process until the student is reading at a quick enough pace. So between, I think, 85 and 100 words per minute. If the student has difficulty, then they can ask, what does a word mean? Or if they hesitate, then the school psychologist will read a word and ask the student to repeat it to show that they understood the correction. So it's interventions like these that are used to help students with learning difficulties succeed in an academic setting. Another one of the strategies that's used for math is incremental rehearsal, and this one comes up too during the interview. So what the school psychologist does is create a deck of cards with math problems on them, and then on the other side there will be the answer. So at first, before really starting the process, the psychologist sits down with the child, or maybe a tutor who's trained by the psychologist will do this, and show a math problem, and if the student can answer it within 2 seconds, then they're considered to be confident with the problem. And that goes into a deck of sort of known problems. And then if they can't answer it that quickly, it just goes into a deck of unknown problems. And then what happens is one unknown card will be introduced into the known deck at a time. So at any given time, there will only be one card in the deck that the student's not confident about. And new cards aren't added to the deck until after the student has shown that they're confident with whatever's in the deck. So this way it sort of keeps material in that the student's confident with while also slowly introducing material that's difficult and needs to be worked on. And that sort of keeps the student's confidence up while also making sure that they are going into that new material.
On the other hand, on the more zoomed out level, on the more school-wide or even district-wide level, school psychologists also have a responsibility for implementing different programs on that larger level that affect students in a more universal way. And an example of this might be school violence prevention. And there are different tiers to how this prevention happens. The first one is, like I said, on a more universal, is the word that's used, level, which means school-wide, district-wide. Each student, regardless of their behavior, is going to receive this kind of prevention strategy. and it works for most of them. So an example of this would be social-emotional education. An example of social-emotional education happens every morning at Saline High School. Saline is a town about 20 minutes away from Ann Arbor, where we are at the University of Michigan. So every morning they do something called Hornet Time, and every grade from freshmen to seniors, they get together in these peer groups of 18 to 24 students, and they're facilitated by a staff member. So each cohort stays together for the entirety of their high school career. So in a way, you're also like forming that sense of community as well. And during Hornet Time, the cohorts socialize and discuss topics that are critical to their success as students and as young adults, like time management, academic integrity, career searching, and even things like meditation. So that would be one example of prevention strategies that are applied at the broad level.
Yeah, and that sort of represents a holistic approach to student wellness, in that there isn't just a problem that needs to be treated, but every student can use some sort of boost in their social and emotional education. At tier two, though, we start seeing where groups of students, maybe, who need some sort of intervention are identified and then helped by a staff member. So the approach here is still very holistic and not really oriented towards any specific issue. It's just that the students who need this are more carefully selected, and it's a smaller proportion than the tier one interventions. So one example of this might be a student meeting with a staff member in the morning to receive a point sheet and talk about their goals for the day, and then receive feedback throughout the day as to how they're doing on those goals, right? So that's a very general thing that might benefit a lot of students and isn't quite addressing any specific issue yet.
Right, just giving that extra support.
Yeah, and that may still have an effect on perhaps preventing violence or preventing a student from needing further intervention, say at the tier three level.
Right, and I mean, I feel like part of it too is just like having a staff member who's invested in you and in your success, I feel like would be really helpful as well.
Yeah.
But then there are those who tier one and tier two might not be enough to address their emotional needs. So students who don't respond well to tiers one or two now get this individualized attention. Maybe their aggressive behavior has been escalating and they've gotten the attention of their teachers or even administration. So one tactic to address the issues of this kind of individual would be something called a wraparound. So multiple support teams are wrapped around, the student to deter problems from escalating. And in the case of school violence, to violence against oneself or one's teachers or fellow students. So a wraparound, some examples of the kind of support received from a wraparound comes from family, school, and the community in response to their behavior. So some services might be anger management counseling, mentoring, aid accompaniment, or even alternative site placement.
Yeah, so that would be what, like relocating them to a different school where they might not have these problems?
Yeah.
Okay. Another situation in which we see school psychologists Another situation in which we see school psychologists administering a lot of one-on-one treatment is with different disorders such as ADHD, which we talked a little bit about in our last episode. Another major responsibility that school psychologists have at the individual level is testing. And a lot of times that comes down to testing for different learning disabilities that may be impacting students' educational experience. And one of these that you hear about a lot, and it makes sense because about 1 in 10 children between the ages of 2 and 17 get diagnosed with this, is ADHD, or Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder.
In the past few decades, diagnoses of ADHD have increased significantly. And this raises questions of, okay, are we getting better at identifying it, or are we possibly over-diagnosing it?
And there's an interesting study coming out of Germany published in the journal Labor Economics titled "The Youngest Get the Pill: ADHD Misdiagnosis in Germany, Its Regional Correlates and International Comparison," which the title just about says it all. Is they find that students who are at the young end of their grade, so who were born just close to the cutoff, to where they would have to wait another year to go to school.
Yeah, so September, October, November.
Yeah, generally around there. So students who are young for their grade are more likely, significantly more likely, to get diagnosed with ADHD as a result of being a little bit less mature than the other students in their grade.
So there's some food for thought.
Yeah, so this finding suggests that these diagnoses may not be due solely to a persistent pattern of behavior that continues throughout childhood, but rather just that the child is not yet mature enough to conform to the standards of the situation that they've been placed in.
Something that was kind of interesting that we found while we were doing our research was one theory from a more evolutionary perspective of the origins of ADHD. And one theory is that when our societies were transitioning from hunter-gatherers to farmers and like settling down, that those who were hyperactive in this hunter-gatherer society, that was something that was adaptive. You had more energy, you were able to spend more time being out, gathering the hunt, that sort of thing.
And the interesting part about this whole theory is that it didn't really derive from any kind of systematic investigation, but rather from a guy just watching how his son behaved.
Hartman, the man who developed the idea, would like us to make sure that it's known that it's not hard science and was never intended to be. That's what it says on the Wikipedia page anyway.
And yet people still take it seriously and use it to inform both research and practice. So it just shows how influential an idea can be, even if there isn't any evidence behind it. And all of that, I think, might speak sort of to the fast and loose diagnosis practices that we might be seeing with ADHD.
One kind of behavior that's common in folks with ADHD is actually hyper-focused, where you just get super into whatever you're doing and you don't want to be distracted. And Hartman proposed in this hunter versus farmer hypothesis that hyper-focus was adaptive for those who were hunters. And then once we transitioned into farming societies, that hyper-focus became less beneficial, as, you know, we often use watching and watering flowers and plants and things like that as a metaphor for patience, which is not something that those with ADHD are the most well known for practicing. And honestly, this hypothesis makes a little bit of sense if you look at the heritability of ADHD.
Yep, we talked a bit a couple episodes ago with Dr. Polk about percent heritability, and the estimated heritability for ADHD is between 76 and 92%, which is huge.
So if your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, the caveman, you know, he had ADHD, maybe that would get passed along.
Yeah. So that does kind of support a genetic factor that may just not have been selected out. We're going to hear more about ADHD and all the controversy surrounding it in our interview with Mrs. Seifert. All right, so we are here today with Ms. Krista Seifert, a school psychologist for Farmington Public Schools. Ms. Seifert, could you tell us a bit about your background in education? How did you get to where you are today?
So I did my undergrad at Otterbein College. It was a liberal arts school in Ohio. And I started out as a journalism major. And because it's a liberal arts school, I was required to take psychology and philosophy and religion and just a wide range of courses. And that's how I took my first psychology course. And one of my professors in a team taught course was a school psychologist, Dr. Lori Rose. And that's how I learned about school psychology. From there, I had to do a lot of service learning projects as just part of the liberal arts experience. And I spent a lot of my time working with at-risk youth. And this is how I had a better idea that I wanted to work in schools or with kids in some capacity. So after undergrad, I did more work with kids as an ABA therapist and did some other random work that wasn't really related to psychology. I worked for a Gannett group, working in their online department. And during that time, I spent my time also applying to graduate schools. And that led me to go to University of Cincinnati for their school psychology program.
What kind of graduate degree do you have?
I first earned my master's in education, and that took about a year to complete. And then from there, I earned a master's, a specialist degree, education specialist, an EDS degree in school psychology. So I spent 3 years in graduate school, and all three of those years were spent in schools doing different things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, so that must have been a lot of hands-on experience then during that graduate program.
Yeah, so the first year they want you to be in schools just observing, at least through my program. They called it the rolling function of the school psychologist. So you were able to meet with principals and sit in on meetings, get to know how different schools functioned. And then during my second year, it was my practicum experience. So I was placed in different school districts with supervision. And again, I was just observing specifically how a school psychologist would function at different levels. So at the preschool, elementary, and high school levels. And then my third year of graduate school was spent working in a district at the preschool, elementary, and high school levels. And I was expected to do all the things that a school psychologist would do under supervision. So I had to complete evaluations, and then I also had to implement interventions at tiers 1, 2, and 3, which is kind of a systematic way that we look at schools. So I had to implement academic and behavioral interventions as well as evaluate students to determine whether they were eligible for special education services.
Okay. And what was it that led you to that graduate program instead of, say, another master's program or a doctoral program?
So I applied to 5 different programs. All of them were in Ohio except for Columbia University, and I was offered interviews at all the programs. What led me to UC's program was the fact that they were almost fully funded. So I was awarded a scholarship my first year, and then I was also awarded an assistantship position in the dean's office. So not only did I get a 100% scholarship, I also got a stipend. So that made the choice pretty easy, whereas the other programs weren't offering scholarships.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've heard that a lot talking to different people about how if anything, if you're going to go to grad school, make sure you'll find somewhere where they're going to pay you for it.
Yeah, for sure. And the reason why I didn't pursue a PhD is because I wanted to work in schools. I really didn't see myself teaching. So really, if you have a PhD, you're not going to get much of a pay difference when you work in public education, unless you are deciding to go on and do research or teach within academia. But that wasn't ever really my goal. So I just wanted to get in, get a degree, and get a job.
So what are some of the different things you do during the course of a day as a school psychologist?
So every day is different, which is why I love being a school psychologist. But my primary responsibilities are always involving staff, students, and then occasionally parents. So from day to day, let's just think about yesterday. I checked in, got my walkie. I carry a walkie with me because if there is a behavior incident at the elementary level, I may be called, or a social worker may be called to respond to that behavior incident in the classroom. So I got my walkie, I checked in with some teachers who I've been working with on certain cases, checked in with other teachers who have students in their classes that I've been working with. And then a substitute wasn't available to cover for a classroom, so I covered for that class. That's usually not something that I do, but it was a special needs class, so those are the students I typically work with. So I was in there for a minute, and then I was called to respond to a student who was having trouble following the group plan. Went into that classroom, tried to redirect that student who was on the teacher's phone and then eventually on the teacher's desk. So then I had to call for backup because that student wasn't responding to me. From there, I went back to my office to complete paperwork. Paperwork is a big part of the school psychologist role.
I can imagine.
Yes. So finalizing some reports for meetings that are coming up. any other day, like the day prior to that, I was in meetings pretty much all day, going over reports with parents. And in those reports is assessment data on their child, and it helps us determine what supports we're going to give students if they're eligible for extra support. So yeah, a lot of the job is also presenting to people and helping them understand many different sources of data and make sense of it, and so that we can all figure out how to support students.
Mm-hmm. We've heard that a big part of a school psychologist's job is things like assessment. How does that factor into your daily life as a school psychologist?
Yes, that is. Assessment is a big part of a school psychologist's job. It helps us make decisions at the system level, so we can collect data school-wide to determine how healthy a building is functioning. Maybe we want to look at reading, so we will screen everyone in reading to see what percentage of peers are proficient and what students are at risk. Based on that data, we can determine, is our system healthy? Do we need to increase our tier one instructional support, or do we need to, is that adequate enough, and do we need to put supports in place for smaller groups of students? So we use data at the system-wide level to make decisions. We also use it on an individual student level. So like I was mentioning earlier, with the evaluations I often do for students who are struggling to learn or struggling to stay in the classroom, maybe due to behaviors, we always use data. So I'm using multiple sources of data to make decisions with teams. That would include doing normed reference assessments, but also using teacher-based assessments that we call curriculum-based measures. We might collect observational data to show us how on task a student is compared to other peers in the classroom. We have a lot of data from the state that we use. So we have the district-wide assessments like NWEA testing. We look at all of the data and look for patterns in that data. And then based on those patterns, we make recommendations for support. So it is a huge part of my job, and it really guides how I make decisions on a daily basis.
I've been doing a lot of reading lately on the third grade reading law that's going into effect this spring. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I am, yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel about that, and how does that impact your job?
Well, the third grade reading guarantee came out when I was working in Ohio, because I was trained in Ohio. So that came out like 5 years ago in Ohio, and Michigan is just now rolling that out now. So I was able to see how it impacted teachers and students, you know, 5 years ago, and then again, pretty much the same effect how it's impacting people here in Michigan. I see what the lawmakers are trying to do with the law. They're trying to make sure that everyone is proficient in reading, but I don't know that they're going about it the right way. I think there are other things that we could do that we're already doing, looking at systems, determining are the systems healthy, are enough students proficient in reading at each grade level, and if not, are we doing things to fix our system and to put supports in place rather than penalizing students who get to third grade and aren't proficient. We need to fix the system. So I think the whole goal is good, that we want students to be proficient in reading, but maybe the way we're getting there is not the best way.
Yeah, I just had a talk today about getting like a minor in education and empowerment, that kind of thing, and that came up, and I didn't know it was something that was so recent, and it is really interesting. The woman who was leading the workshop said a very similar thing about how it's interesting how you're kind of penalizing the individuals for having the system fail them. And
right.
I wonder, like looking into working on something like education, when there are all these macro structures, things that are so systematic, how do you stay optimistic that it is getting better for student success?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. And it is, working in a system is really difficult, because if you work in a system that isn't using updated practices, isn't using universal screeners to determine the health of their building or how proficient students are in the core areas of reading, writing, and math, if they're so far away from these newer practices, it's really hard to figure out a way to move them towards this mark. System work takes a lot of collaboration, but it also takes, it requires administrators to see that need and to be open to doing things differently. So once your administration is on board, that's when you can start to see some movement. But change takes a lot of time. When I worked in Ohio, I was fortunate enough to work in two different districts where I was able to implement different programs. The first district was a rural district, and they had a large migrant population. And these students were over-referred for special education because they didn't have an English language program for these students that didn't speak English. So these students were failing, but not because they had learning disabilities, it's because they didn't know English. And special education was the only program that was available to them in this district. So I was able to help administration see what was wrong here, and they were open to working with me on implementing a new program, an English language program, a screener to identify these students, to monitor their progress, and so forth. And then that led me to another position where I was able to implement a similar program for reading. So we're screening everybody, we're identifying the at-risk students and putting supports in place. None of that would have been possible though without strong leadership to see the need and then to get on board with working with me and then working with teachers on getting them to buy into this, because you can't do things differently if the people who are on the ground floor are not going to do anything differently. So you have to get teacher buy-in, and all of that takes a long time. So it took over 3 years to get a reading program fully implemented, where we're screening the students and we're grouping them according to what their needs were during a best fit time. So it really started slowly, and hopefully it's still in place now, but you just have to be hopeful and hope that your administration will be open to doing things differently if you're in a system that isn't functioning as properly as it could or as best as it could.
So you mentioned collaboration with administrators and teachers. What are those relationships like, and what other professionals do you interact with on a daily basis?
Yeah, so the special education team consists of a speech-language pathologist, special education teachers, occupational therapists, and in some occasions a physical therapist or an adaptive phys ed teacher. And all of us work together depending on how involved the case is. On some cases, I'm just working with the special ed teacher and the general ed teacher. In other cases, if a student has more significant needs, I might be working with the speech path, the OT, and more related service providers. So we all work together to identify at the beginning of an evaluation what a student's needs are, and then based on what the student's needs are, we will determine what our evaluation plan will look like, and everyone will determine what assessments they will do in order to like give us good information within the evaluation. So I'm working with them at the beginning of an evaluation to figure out a plan. And then at the end, I'm writing up the report and getting summaries from all of these team members. And I'm kind of consolidating the report, which is what we present to the teacher and the team. The parents get a copy of this report. So I make sure that everybody's parts are in the report and everything is good to go. The data is clear so that a layperson can read it and understand it. So that's in one way that I collaborate with them. We also work together whenever at the end of an evaluation, when we have all of our data, we sit down and talk about it as a team to talk about next steps and eligibility and what supports the student would need. I collaborate with teachers through the entire course of an evaluation. So at the beginning, I get any data that a teacher has. I work with them on setting up a time for me to go in their room to observe the student. I really want the teacher to be involved because they are a member of the team as well. Even though they're not a core evaluator, they are giving information and they do work with that student every day. So it's really important to make sure that the teacher and that I'm communicating with the teacher throughout the evaluation. I also work with the teacher on interventions. So if the student just needs some remediation and where it's separate from special education or special ed eval, then I may do some consultation with the teacher. So for example, this year I had a student who had some behaviors, had some struggles with transitioning to school and learning school and the routine and following class directions and so forth. So I worked with that teacher on coming up with a specific plan for that student. And then I regularly went in and touched base with that teacher to see how things were going, to help her collect the data. So it's important to always be in touch with teachers if you're working with them on cases, because they're ultimately the person implementing the intervention. So yeah, collaboration is huge. And I think being a part of the school and being in the hallways and getting to know teachers is a big first step to being an effective collaborator with teachers, because they have to see you and see you as someone who's helpful and someone that they're willing to go and talk to if they have a concern or a problem about a student. So yeah, it's a big part of the job.
It sounds like you're very much the maestro, like kind of pulling everybody together for the student's success, orchestrating all of these different collaborations. And that is really cool to have that leadership role. It's a lot of responsibility. How much time do you get to interact one-on-one with the students?
That's actually limited. Most of the work that I do as a school psychologist and have historically done, and then when I talk to colleagues, most of the work that the traditional role of a school psychologist does is indirect service delivery. So we're collaborating with teachers and they're implementing the intervention, where I'm evaluating a student for maybe 2-3 hours total, and then I don't see that student again. So it's really kind of hands off with students. Some of the newer roles will allow students to work more directly with students in groups, but that's pretty rare. Most of our work is spent testing and then consulting with teachers, but really not spending a lot of time directly servicing students.
How many cases or children do you work with, say, in the course of a month?
Evaluation-wise, I would say it ranges anywhere from 10 to 20 cases a month, like evaluations. And then on top of that, I do collaborations with teachers, which could range from 1 to 10 cases a month. Okay. So it just varies, really. And it does vary according to the time of the year. In the spring, there seems to be more of a rush because teachers just remembered that this kid has been struggling all year and something needs to be done before the end of the school year. So they refer the student and want help ASAP. So it seems that there is more of a need in the spring, whereas in the fall, teachers are just getting to know students. So there's not that urgent need. So yeah, it's pretty chill right now, but the spring is where it would really heat up.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
What part of your day is the most fun?
I don't know. That's a hard question. So I think the best part of any of my day would be when I am in a classroom, seeing how the classroom functions, seeing what students are learning. That is more fun than sitting in an office writing reports, which a lot of my time is spent doing. So I really do like to get out into the classroom, be out in the hallway, see students, see teachers, see what's going on. That's more exciting to me.
And then what's the most challenging aspect of your job?
I think the biggest challenge, like when I was new as a school psychologist, the biggest challenge was the disconnect between graduate training and then being in the field. And that continues to be a challenge, and I'm 10 years in. It just seems like the mentorship wasn't there for me. And I hear this from a lot of school psychologists, where you get all that supervision in grad school for a couple of years, and then you're all of a sudden on your own. And there are things like listservs and Facebook groups for school psychologists, but there's not someone that you meet with on a regular basis to talk about cases. And I found that to be extremely challenging. So my learning curve was extremely sharp whenever I got out into the field. And my first position, I was the only school psychologist K-12 for a whole district. So I had no colleagues to consult with in a district that had some questionable practices that I hadn't encountered in grad school, because I was only in placements that had best practices implemented. So I was really struggling with, what do I do in a system that doesn't have all these newer practices? So I felt like that was a big struggle for me in my first 5 years as a school psych. And I still struggle with that now, even though I have colleagues that I can consult with. It would be so helpful to have a mentor or someone who's there specifically to talk about cases, and someone who's more seasoned, who can give feedback and kind of help me develop as a professional. So I think that is a big area of growth that could be addressed within the field of school psychology. And then the other challenge, I think just working within the public sector, is that we're always dealing with new laws that are coming out and new regulations, and school psychologists have to follow federal and state laws. So we have to be aware of what those laws are, and we're bound by those laws. If you're working within a system where a student's struggling, but special education is the only kind of remedial support in the building, then it's difficult to say a student's not eligible when there's no other support in place within the building. So resources are really tight in public education, and that's why some schools don't have the funds to have many layers of interventions for students who may struggle. So the limited resources, and then the continual legislation that's always changing is a challenge in public education.
So with the two of us being undergraduate students, we do a lot of reading about research on various topics, and we've been seeing a lot about prevention efforts in school for a lot of different things. How much of your work is prevention focused?
Yeah, ideally all of my work is prevention focused, because our whole goal as school psychologists is to promote student success. So if we can, if we can put early interventions into place and prevent students from failing, falling through the cracks, that's exactly what we want to do. So that's the whole idea behind the multi-tiered systems of support. It's a newer practice that many districts endorse. Some districts struggle to have the funds to implement it. But what it is, it's a great way to prevent students from failing. And also it's a great way to identify students who need support across tiers. So at tier one, it's your core curriculum. So you want to make sure that about 80% of your student population is achieving benchmarks at tier one. So that means your core curriculum is strong in reading, writing, and math. If 80% of your students are proficient on different universal screeners that are administered, then you know that your tier one is strong, and then you can focus on tier two. Tier two is where about 15 to 20% of your student population will need extra support. They're not responding adequately to tier one instruction, so they may need supplemental intervention at tier two, typically a small group. Some districts do it as a best fit time. So during that time, students break up and they go into groups that will target their instructional needs. And then tier three is reserved for 1% to 5% of the population, and that's a really intense level of support. So these students may need individualized plans, such as a behavior plan. But this is what a healthy system looks like. 80% of our students are proficient. If we see that tier one's not strong, less than 80% of our students are proficient and they're not responding to tier one instruction. So we look at what can we do to make our curriculum at tier one stronger? And are we giving students, you know, enough reading instruction during the day? Is it curriculum? Or is it just teachers pulling together materials off of teachers pay teachers? So we look at what exactly is happening during instruction, what can we do to strengthen the instruction, and then we want to make sure that if we put initiatives in place that students are responding positively to those initiatives. So of course we're going to collect more data, so we'll collect data to see if any of the interventions we implemented were effective. So we do all of that within a healthy system to prevent students from failing, to catch them early so that we can remediate any deficits that may be in place.
So that's great. Then you really do get to work at all levels of the system.
In a strong system. Many districts are working towards having multi-tiered systems of supports, but many districts don't have MTSS. It's a goal. A lofty goal that they're working towards, but really very few districts do have MTSS in place.
So what strategies might you use to try and implement some of these support systems in a district where there's are fewer resources available?
Yeah, so luckily these a multi-tiered system of support can be implemented even if there are a lower level of resources within a district. You just have to get creative. So in the second district I was in Ohio, that was a common pushback, is we don't have the resources to do something like this. This is too big. It's too different from what we're already doing. We don't have the manpower. So we got creative. We involved tutors. We involved people who you wouldn't necessarily think would be in a teaching role to do some of the best fit grouping. So of course we wanted teachers in our groups with the students who needed that intense intervention. We wanted teachers teaching those groups, but for the students that just needed repetition or acceleration, those were larger groups, and those could be overseen by paraprofessionals who were trained to oversee those groups. So we use staff in different ways to make sure that every group was serviced properly. For in terms of interventions, we were able to find resources that were affordable to the district. There are a lot of programs that are made available through ISDs. Those are kind of support schools for counties. So you can often get training and resources for your district from the overarching ISD in your area. So we utilized our ISD to do training and to support us with different programming. So the other thing that we did is we used interventions that we could make. So like incremental rehearsal, that's something that you can easily make on your own. You don't need, it's a research-based intervention, but you don't need to buy a program to do incremental rehearsal or repeated reading or peer tutoring. So we were able to choose interventions that we could create on our own, but were still proven to be effective at remediation. So we just tried to think outside of the box, and I think we were able to do it, but with the support of administration, kind of really promoting it and getting everybody on board. That was a key piece to it.
As a school psychologist, does, especially in the high school setting, mm-hmm. how does your work address violence prevention?
Yeah, so one of the key things that I have been a part of historically, and I'm new to the high school I'm in now, so I'm just learning what they're doing, but a key component at the high school level that administration was really promoting and that I was a part of was building relationships with students and getting to know all students. A part of that was having these groups on a weekly basis. It was kind of like a study hall, but not really. It was called Hornet Time, and it was a time where you got together with a smaller group and you were with that group for the whole 4 years of high school. So it's kind of like a place where you have this one adult that you're always seeing every week. That adult gets to know all the students in that group, and they do team building activities. They kind of just get to know each other as a cohort, and you stick with that cohort for the full 4 years that you're in high school. The whole idea is that you're keeping an eye on students, and you're able to get to know students and see if there are any changes in behavior, but also students are hopefully making a good connection with a positive adult. So that was one effort that my former high school made, was to really get to know students. There was a hotline so that if any students had concerns about anything, they could anonymously call the hotline and leave their comment. So there was that. And I think the biggest thing was just the weekly administration meetings that were had, where we talked about students, student concerns, students who had been to the counseling office, students who had been brought up by parents. And we would just go through the list and talk about those students, who was supporting them, who was checking in with them. I had students I checked in with on a weekly basis. So it was kind of all hands on deck, where students were indirectly helped by different adults in the building. And then there were these weekly groups where students always were able to connect with an adult. And I feel like that was really effective in making students feel like it was a strong community, even though, you know, they didn't always like Hornet time, but they still had an adult. Like every student I'd always asked, do you have an adult that you'd feel comfortable approaching if you needed a support? Every student was always able to come up with at least one adult. So I think those connections are really important piece to that.
Yeah, definitely. So both making sure that students are feeling that sense of belonging that's so important, and then also making sure that they're comfortable if there's anything that they need to talk about.
Absolutely.
We've heard and read a lot about people who think that ADHD is being overdiagnosed today. What do you think about that as a school psychologist?
Yeah, well, the school psychologist isn't directly involved in making diagnoses or following the DSM and making diagnoses. But we do collect data within the school setting to determine whether a student's diagnosis of ADHD from a medical doctor is impacting their learning. Based on any discrepancies we see between a student's engagement, their ability to demonstrate strong executive functioning during the school day or not, based on what we see, we come up with interventions to address any skill gaps that are evident, and hopefully we can try to remediate or accommodate the student to reduce the impact that any attention deficit could have on their learning. But we do see it's a big diagnosis. Yeah, it's like under the other health impaired special ed education, or so do you guys know about the eligibility categories? Okay, so in order to be eligible for special education services, which are federally funded services, you have to be eligible under one of 13 categories. And one of them is the other health impaired category. And that's what ADHD would fall under if it's negatively impacting a student's ability to learn. So under the OHI category, ADHD is like the number one medical diagnosis that I see. And over the past 10 years of me doing this, it's been the number one diagnosis that I've seen. So I think it's just something that I've always seen. I haven't seen a change since I've been in the field, but when I talk to other more seasoned school psychologists, they have seen a change. But maybe it's a change in the way that diagnoses are made. I don't know. Or maybe it's technology. I don't know. But it does seem to be prevalent. Another thing to keep in mind is that with the high-stake testing that's in place in almost every state, students are expected to sit a lot longer and learn with the Common Core, learn a lot deeper and a lot more. And a lot of time is spent sitting, and maybe not as much time is spent up doing. So that also, maybe we're having students sit longer than they should, especially at the lower grades. So there are many factors that could contribute to that.
Yeah, and that whole focus on testing kind of even, and on high stakes testing ties back even to what we were talking about with the third grade reading law and retention.
Yeah, it does.
You mentioned earlier that you're not the one who gives out the DSM-5 diagnoses to children.
Right.
Let's say if a teacher does have a concern about a student with attention problems, what would the flow of work and information look like from that teacher's concern to a diagnosis?
That's a good
and who
question.
Would be involved?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, you guys are good. So it really depends on the system you're in. So in my former district that had a lot of resources, we were able to give out rating scales, do observations, collect data from our end, which includes the parent input as well, and kind of interpret that data and provide recommendations for what we can do at school. Then we give that short child study report to the parent, and they can choose to share that with their pediatrician so they can talk about their concerns and what exactly is being seen within the school setting. They can share that with their doctor, and then they can come up with a course of action with their pediatrician. That was the course of action in my former district, because we had the resources to use those rating scales, and I had the extra time to do those assessments on students that were not special ed related. In my current district, most likely we would not do that. We would, if a teacher had a concern, we would have them discuss it with the parent, and the parent could choose to share that concern with their pediatrician if they also had that concern. It really just depends on the district and what their policies are.
In talking with a lot of different psychologists in different fields, a lot of people have different input on the role of national organizations and what it is that they do. What role does the National Association of School Psychologists play, or maybe even the APA, or I think it's Division 16 of the APA, but I'm not entirely sure. Like, what role do those organizations play? And then how much of school psychology do you think should be dictated by national standards versus what the people in the district think is best?
Yeah, so I think the role of the National Association of School Psychologists is to advocate for school psychologists. And they do this. They work with lobbyists and they try to help lawmakers understand that there should be a lower school psych to student ratio. And they, I think, regularly advocate for this. They really don't come out with laws and tell us what we should and should not do, but they come out with best practices and guidance documents that will help us, that can be very helpful in situations where we need an outside source. So of course, we're going to consult research, but also we can contact a white paper from NASP and see what do they say about retention. And then their white paper will have research and kind of their stance on retention. So they're a great resource whenever you need information that you may need for just a random problem or a random case that you have. So in terms of like outside laws, I think outside laws, this is tricky. We're always going to have outside laws because special education is kind of guided by federal laws, IDEA, and then Michigan laws that enforce IDEA is MRC. So we're always going to have to follow these laws. And they're pretty general. Well, I mean, they give us, you know, some room for clinical judgment in them, but they're always going to be there. They do allow districts to come up with ways they're going to do things. Like, for example, under the specific learning disability eligibility, they say that schools can choose to do use a pattern of strengths and weaknesses to identify LD or something else. So they have different options that districts can choose. So they do kind of keep it open to districts. So I do think it's important for districts to have that option to kind of come up with the way they're going to do things. So yeah, it's important to have guidance, but then also important for districts to have the freedom to do things that fit their culture and what their goals are.
Yeah, it's really cool you get that flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and that question kind of came out of what you were saying earlier about how when you first went to work as a school psychologist, it was in a district that wasn't practicing a lot of the best practices.
Yeah.
So I guess the main thing I'm curious about is what do you think the balance should be between making sure that districts are using best practices as much as can be done and also allowing districts freedom to do what they want?
The balance. Well, the balance is, I guess, you just have to hope that people stay informed and on top of research and on top of best practices so that they're implementing them. And if they're not, you just have to hope that administration is going to be open to evolving and changing as times change and as research evolves. So it's a tough question. Yeah.
How has the field of school psychology changed in the last few decades?
I think back in the day, school psychologists just tested and placed students in special education. I hear from old school psychologists who talked about handwriting reports, and they would just be like 2 pages, and basically they would see a student and then recommend them for special education. And I don't know that there was the emphasis on remediation, early intervention back then. Now we try to do all that we can to remediate, to prevent students from needing special education. We try to prevent educational casualties, as sometimes we call them, by doing all of these different interventions so that we don't have to refer as many students to special education. Yes, a lot of students do need special education, but a lot of students can be remediated if they have skill deficits. So I think the role has changed in that sense, is that school psychologists in the perfect position would be spending a lot of time doing interventions and working within a system where they're developing those interventions and helping collect and analyze the data within that system in order to promote that whole prevention piece. So in a perfect system, there would be that equal emphasis on the intervention and then the evaluation assessment piece. But it really just depends on the role you're in. Every district's different. Some are more heavy on the testing, whereas some are more split, and you have more freedom to do the intervention along with the testing that you're going to be required to do. And in some situations, you do get to work one-on-one with kids, but that's more rare.
And then how do you hope that the field in general is going to change over the next few decades?
Well, I guess it all depends on what happens to public education. But I would love for the school psychologist position to evolve so that people know more about us. People still are confused about what a school psychologist is in the buildings where I serve. So it would be wonderful if we could have a role where we're more engaged with teachers and students and doing interventions and developing systems that promote prevention and early intervention practices. It would be great to be doing that more than just testing and sitting in a room writing reports and doing paperwork, which the paperwork is extensive. So I'm hoping that maybe legislation can evolve so that we're not doing so much paperwork to be compliant with laws and spending more time working with students and developing systems that will ultimately better serve students. Because school psychologists have a lot of training, and sometimes I feel like positions pigeonhole us into doing only one piece of our training and only developing that one area of our expertise where we can do so much more. So hopefully the field will evolve and allow us to do more than just test and place.
So how has studying and practicing psychology influenced how you view other people in the world, or other people and the world in a more general sense?
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway from psychology, school psychology, working with people, is understanding that behind every behavior, behind every word, action, there's a backstory that I don't always get to see. I don't get to see that piece of the puzzle. So I really think that over time we'll develop more empathy in anyone who is in a position such as a school psychologist position. So I'm always kind of thinking about what is motivating someone, why someone may be acting a certain way. And it really helps you begin to think more dimensionally than just interpreting exactly what you're seeing. There's always more to the picture. And I think that's something that you will learn quickly once you're study psychology or once you're in the field of school psychology.
So then to close out, this is, I think, our favorite question. What if you could give one piece of advice to an undergraduate who wants to do what you do someday, what would it be?
If you're interested in school psychology, I would recommend shadowing a school psychologist for a while, not just a day, but go in, interview them, learn what they do on a day-to-day basis. What exactly are they doing? Would you be happy doing those things on a daily basis? Because a lot of it is paperwork related. And that's a big shock. Even during my practicum and internship, I didn't do as much paperwork as I had to do in the field. So really understanding what they do on a daily basis, getting a feel for public speaking, because you do a lot of public speaking as a school psychologist. You have to present information to people with varying degrees of education. So think about, do you like to present information? Can you work with conflict? Because sometimes you're presenting information that's not going to make people happy. How can you deliver that in a way that people can understand and will accept? And how can you navigate conflict? Thinking about those things and if you'd be comfortable learning how to do those tasks, because those are big parts of being a school psychologist. So getting to know what it is and seeing it and figuring out if that's a good fit, I think is a good place to start if you're interested in school psychology.
That's all I got.
Thank you.
That's all I got too. Yeah. Honestly.
All right. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
You guys have good questions.
Thank you.
Really. You do.
Thank you, Mrs. Seifert, for lending all of your knowledge and insight and experience as a school psychologist and what it's like to do that work in the field that comes from all of that research that us academics are doing.
Yes, absolutely. It is so cool to be getting that information about these more applied fields. If you have any ideas for referrals, please reach out to us via email.
Yep, and thank you, Dr. Seifert, for your referral.
To stay up to date on our next couple of episodes, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Preoc Podcast, or follow us on Facebook at Preoccupied, a psych podcast.
You can send us an email to hosts@pre-occupied.com or go to that website for more information.
And of course, you can always follow or subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
Yep, ratings and reviews are nice. If you enjoyed this episode, maybe check out episode
10.
Yeah, 10, with Scott Greenspan, a PhD candidate in school psychology.
Yeah, or if child psychology interests you as well, our last episode with Dr. Tannenbaum has lots of good information about that as well.
And we will see you next time on Preoccupied. Yep, and if you like the name Seifert, go check out episode 4 with Dr. Seifert.
We're stupid.
I know.
We're so dorky. Oh, my God. Oh, my gosh.
Yes, I love it. And it's perfect.
Yes.